Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics, made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like us. Yeah, here we go. Series 2, episode 18. I'm Robin Griffiths, full-time physics teacher.
And I'm Thomas WP, a part-time A-level, mostly physics teacher, still doing chemistry with Year 7.
Chemistry with Year 7, I love that. We're going to have to do an episode on chemistry with Year 7. I we'll have to disguise it as physics teaching somehow, but, you know, I think a lot of physics teachers teach chemistry, don't they? I think
they do.
And a lot of them teach biology when they shouldn't, but there we go. That's a different story.
Yes, you can always disguise chemistry as physics, can't you? Like I do with the colours of the indicators.
Absolutely. You always opportunistically look for ways to squeeze physics into your chemistry.
Yes. It's pretty hard with neutralisation, which is what I'm doing this week.
This is it. It's what I did with maths whenever I was teaching maths, which I had to do for a year because they were a little bit short on timetable. I always used to try and work out, and they said, use real world problems. I said, great, okay, an atom exists in an excited state. With
Anyhow, physics in the news. We're recording this face to face, we should say, if it sounds any different.
Absolutely.
You handed me a magazine, Physics World, which is all about the world of physics, I guess.
Yes, it comes with your Institute of Physics membership, by the way, everybody. IOP.org. Look for membership.
Yeah, yes. Not a member. And you've hurt my brain. But with entanglement.
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it?
You said there's a quantum field that links every particle in the universe to stop them all being the same.
It can stop any two being the same, I think, isn't it? Isn't that the idea? I think that's quantum field. I mean, you know, I'm no expert, but as from what I can gather, and I was always comforted by Richard Feynman's words, that if you think you understand it, you don't. I think that there is this idea that... that's what they base the whole idea of quantum computing on. I think this should be my homework for
this
half-term.
I'm going to say this is. I feel like my A-level students do. It's so far over my head. I just don't even know where to start.
But if you read some of these stories that are coming out about quantum computing, and excuse me if I get the details of these wrong, everybody, please do write in, by the way, because it's always good. But and I know physics teachers love that when they know something that other people don't. They go, oh, I think you're fine. You've got that right. So please do write in and tell me I've got this wrong. But as I understand it, they have actually got entangled particles at remote locations to be linked so that they can...
Well, I've read about that, and I believe in entangled particles because I've read enough about it. Mm. They have them 5 metres apart.
Yeah, so 5 metres apart, and these particles...
Yeah, on an atomic scale, that's stunningly far apart.
Absolutely. So typically an atom is an angstrom, isn't it? 10 to the minus 10?
Yeah, I mean it's...
So they're 11 orders of magnitude away.
Yes, a lot further away than New York is on human scale.
Yeah, exactly. Phenomenal, isn't it? Amazing stuff. So quantum computing, another leap forward. And the thing I thought was really good, and you know, lest we forget, this is January, the month of Brexit and all the rest of it. It's good to celebrate the things that we do well in this country. And one of the things we do very, very well indeed is physics research and science research generally. We record this podcast not very many miles from Cambridge, where the Cambridge Science Park does amazing things, where ARM started off, the people whose chips are in pretty much every mobile device in the world. Yeah, we do a lot of good stuff here, and it's important to... tell that to the kids as well, because when they sit there going, why should I study this? That perennial question that all teachers love. It's because science is one of the things we do pretty well on the global stage. And you know, hubris aside, there aren't that many things that we are head and shoulders above other nations of our size and economy on. And science is one of them.
You're soapboxing again.
I am, aren't I? I'm monologuing.
But going back to quantum computers, one of the things they're supposed to be very good at is encryption, isn't it? And cracking codes, because they can hold a qubit that can be any number that the number of bits can create, any number all the time. But if they learn to crack encryption with it, then no one's ever going to tell you, are they? No one's going to say it's done that, because it'll be such a top secret discovery. They can crack every single bit of encryption in the world. We'll never hear about it.
Well, that's true. Or until, you know, somebody cracks my credit card and then starts, you know, spending money on stuff in Alabama, which is, yeah, exactly. Because that's what they're all wanting to do, you understand. No paranoia here. No.
Anyway, we should talk about physics teaching, Robin, and we were thinking about this, weren't we? We should talk about mocks.
Yeah, it is that season when, and I noticed people tweeting their huge pile of mock scripts. I thought that's quite a nice thing to tweet. Tweet the stack of marked mocks that you've done. It's always makes you feel better. Also illustrates the ludicrous workload that teachers face at mock time of year. And of course, off the back of that, you've then got, what do you do next? If this is going to be a useful exercise, you've got to kind of feed it back. So when you are giving mocks back to students, how do you use all of that hard work that you've done in marking to basically make it a benefit to the kids?
Yeah, so we thought we'd talk about what we do for mocks. I mean, my only teach A-level at the moment that would do mocks, but that you teach GCSE, so 16-year-olds as well. And then we thought we'd talk about how we motivate kids and use the mock papers for feedback as well. So,
absolutely.
Hopefully we know what we're talking about. So I do something different for A-level mocks, and I have done the last 3 years. I used to do the old chestnut of last year's A-level paper delivered at mock time. And then two years ago, I started doing the previous year's AS paper, just AS.
Oh, right.
So I didn't have all the shenanigans of removing questions and creating a full exam. They get the full exam, just AS. And my rationale was to get them really deep into the AS content because it's so important. So I tell them from the start of the year, this is what you're doing, and then the mocks at the end of the first term. This year we did it before Christmas. Ridiculous. So early. So it made sense then because we had done hardly any A2. But that was my rationale, was just to make them really concentrate on the AS stuff. I honestly don't think it made a blind bit of difference to the final result.
Yeah.
It worked, but it just made it a lot easier making the paper.
Yeah, which has a virtue in its own right. I'm not going to argue against that. But it's interesting, isn't it? But one of the things, so all of my teaching experience, because I went to work for the IOP for 2 years, ASs were around, and the school that I ended up teaching in just before I took my hiatus from teaching at IOP, was still running ASs. So we always had the AS public exam the year before. Now working with A-level kids who haven't done that high-stakes exam at the end of year 12, you notice the difference. Oh boy, you notice the difference. A lot of them just didn't bother working for the exam at the end of year 12, thought year 12 was a bit of a year off, all this sort of thing. So we've got to kind of resurrect the traditional things that people did before ASs were even introduced, and I was wondering if any listeners might be able to tell us some tips on that.
I wonder if it's made a difference to mine. I so long since I've done an AS exam in the middle of the year, I don't really remember. I felt it. I never liked that AS exam because they didn't really want that qualification, and it took a huge chunk out of the year. I mean, I go even slower now through the content because we don't have that blocked out bit in the middle of the year, and I still get more done in the first year than I used to, because you'd stop teaching at Easter, wouldn't you? And then you'd revise for the silly exam that they didn't want.
Which, Ed, you're right, but the advantage of it was that they did get themselves belt and braces on that material the previous year. So when it came to the end of year 13, they were just that little bit further ahead. Every time you revise something, every time you do it deeply, you remember it a little bit more. And so I think they were just a bit more prepared at the end of year 13. Certainly my year 13s now, if I ask them anything about anything they've done in year 12, oh my goodness me, they are so adrift. What superposition?
I'm pulling faces, dear listener. You can't see that. I'm pulling faces, Robin, because my kids have always been like that in the second year, whether they did the AS or not.
I thought you had wind.
I think, I guess that's a philosophical thing, isn't it? Are they better prepared? It'd be interesting to see what other people think.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see that. And so we are here with year 13s with their mock papers back, and I tend to, in my head at least, have this theory that your students, and this could apply to year 11s as well, fall into one of two camps. There's either the student that a poor grade in their mock is going to demoralise them to the point where they just give up. So they need a lot of, well, you know, you've got to see. And so that means you scored, you know, 55-60% of the marks. And, you know, to get that up to your target grade, you've just got to get 70%. So you've just got to score an extra mark for every 6 marks you're scoring. That's not a big deal, surely, blah, blah, blah. Give them that boost and try and get them up to their target grade that way. Or, of course, then you've got the kids who do really well in their mocks, and you're thinking, oh, crikey, they're going to sit there and think, well, physics is sorted. Don't have to do any of that until I walk into the exam hall in June. Because I can now focus on one of the subjects where I'm weaker. And those ones you need to say, well, you know, you've done well here, but you've got to keep it ticking over. You've got to keep that level up. You've got to focus on the remaining material in the same level that you did to get that great mock score. You know, you don't get success by accident.
I tend to agree with you. I think I agree with the first one much more. The person who is a big kick up the backside. That's much more common. But the people who do roaringly well, physics is hard. And all the mock tells you, I feel, and this is a quote from my uncle actually, all the mock tells you is someone who's not ready for the exam is not yet ready for the exam. It doesn't tell you much. I think people maybe take them too seriously. I've always done just the whole school mock in around Christmas when it comes, and I always say to the kids, this one is for you. I'm not that bothered how you do because it's so early. The one that matters, I always give them a full mock at the last year paper, the full thing, the first lesson back after Easter. I do it in lesson time. So my first three or four lessons back are just doing exams.
Right.
And I tell them that that exam is the one that really counts. And that holiday is the holiday which you have to sacrifice if you want to boost your grade. And I show them stats of the grades people get at Easter versus what they get in the summer. And I've got years of that data now and show them how, on the standard scheme of things, people will go up one grade from Easter, and it's very rare someone goes up two grades from Easter, and it's reasonably common that people stay there and occasionally go down. But that milestone at Easter is really important. They get to there as best they can.
This shall be known as WP's Law. WP's Law states that the vast majority of students put on one grade from Easter. I like it. It's good. And I think, that is a really useful thing to be able to do. But it sounds like what you're doing is basically saying the mock is what it is. But actually, the real mock, and I'm doing the inverted commas thing here just to annoy everyone, yeah. The inverted commas thing mock, is the series of tests that you do leading up to the real thing.
Yeah, the full mock, the full paper is 6 weeks before the exam, and you should be fully into your revision by then. And if you're not, that mock shows it. And occasionally people do terribly on that, and they only got one grade. It sorts them out.
Mm.
I'm not sure it makes a huge difference to them going forward. But occasionally people got a grade or two grades is very. I've had the odd D go to a B. But usually they get the same or above.
How formal do you make the kind of revision of things? Do you sit there and give them a list of the topics that they've done and say you should be familiar? This week, focus your year 12 revision on the waves topic. This year, focus it on the quantum topic.
I took a relief out of your book, actually. When we worked together, you gave them a huge pile of photocopied past papers.
Mm.
So I give them that, and I say, I tend not to focus it on a particular topic. I say, look, you must have done this paper by this day.
Yeah.
I won't go through the paper, that's pointless, but you can ask me questions about it, and I'll have questions ready based around the questions in that paper. But I also do practicals as part of revision, because I think that's so important. I give them a pencil and say, I want you to work out with this micrometer the volume of the lead, and then I want you to work out the resistance of the lead if I give you its resistivity, and then they can test it, and that takes them through some skills and some data.
Give them some data. Well, that's the thing. I do EdXL A level now, and one of the real high points of EdXL A level is their paper 3, where they do all the practical skills. I think some of those questions in there are really testing and really good questions. It's one of the assessment bits I like the most about EdXL. So it is a good thing to remember that there should be some practical work in there just to give them.
Yeah, the paper 3 is at A level. Definitely. I remember turning over the first time I've been doing AQA. The first A-level paper 3 they had, and I opened it after when I got the paper back, and it was a picture of a vernier they had to read, and I was like punching the air, going, finally, yeah, this is good. This is a good thing. And I like that. I love them. I mean, I'm so practical-based. I love those things. I like the ones where it shows you the fringes, and then they have to tell you how to measure the distance between the fringes and the uncertainty. I like that. Do you do practical, let's say it's after Easter, you've got your 35 year 11s and they in your badly designed lab, and you've got six weeks, maybe you've maybe got 9 lessons left with them before their exam. What do you do? Do you do any practical work? Would you do practicals?
Definitely. I definitely do a few lessons on, and what it would be centred around would be the core practicals that we have. And what I'd like to do is ask the technician to get a set of apparatus for, say, 6 of them, put them around the room, give the kids maybe a sheet of A3 or something like that they split into 6 to go round. They look at the equipment. They say, okay, what is this practical? Write down a bullet point method, do a diagram of the equipment, set it up, try and get at least one reading out of it just to remind yourself what this is about, and then note down any things that you think are particularly important about this, data that you might get asked about, something that you think might be a wrinkle of this experiment that they might highlight in the exam.
I think that's a really sensible idea. I mean, I think were I teaching year 11 at the moment, I would definitely be doing, I like that, a carousel of
circus.
You circus won that cold, isn't it? I pinned that on our Twitter. I think Circus won with 66%, but I was proud that Carousel got more than got a third. Anyway, I would do Carousel exactly the same. And I think that's a really they don't have to do the full practical, but they do have to be familiar with the practical. And some of them, these RPs, with the best will in the world, there's not enough equipment to do it as a class practical anyway. So if you do that, they've got a chance to have a go at it, like the Speed of Sound one. With the microphone and the oscilloscope. I mean, we've got two microphones in the school and four oscilloscopes. You know, good luck doing that as a class practical. So it does give them that opportunity. I would definitely do that too. Like I say, with A-level, I drop in little ones, particularly the skills ones that I think are going to come up in the paper three and uncertainty. Do you teach them analog voltmeters and ammeters?
No.
We do
have them, and
I love it.
I love them actually because they're really, really useful for zero error and systematic errors.
Exactly.
It's a lovely way to demonstrate.
And you can teach them how to zero them, and they're bound to meet them.
And the great thing about them, of course, is you can fiddle with the zeroing screw as well, and you can set them with a zero error, so you can show them that immediately that this ammeter is overreading by half an amp every time. So you need to take half an amp off every reading. It's a really easy thing to see. Much more so than with a digital, which tend not to
They're also useful for discharge charge experiments with capacitors, because you can see the movement, you can see the rate of change, which you can't really with a digital. So I do like to use analog, and as I say, they're great for uncertainty, and also because they have three plugs at the bottom, a common, and then a 5 and a 15, and then the scale on the top has 0 to 5 on the bottom and 0 to 15 on the top, and they have to work that out, or in my case 0 to 1 on the bottom and 0 to 5 on the top.
I'll tell you one thing I have done actually, this, which is a relatively recent addition, and it was because working with Jane, who we both know, we worked with before, and she does this, which I think is really useful. She gets A-level, GCSE, really doesn't matter, she gets them to think about independent variable, dependent variable, and control variables, and just think, okay, what are they in this experiment? And so every core practical, what's the IV, what's the DV, what are the CVs? So that you've got that, they think about, because just the act of thinking about those makes you think about the experiment actually quite deeply. You know, what are you controlling and why? That tells you a lot. And if you can answer that, you can answer pretty much any question on the core practical.
If I'm looking at you a bit confused, I do that for every practical in lower school. I mean, my year sevens are already drilled the independent control. Funnily enough, I don't do it so much with A-level, but I feel I can just talk about them as a thing, because they have got that knowledge. I can just say, you know, just make a note of your control variables, and, you know, independent on the x-axis for this, dependent on the y, and they know what I'm talking about.
And you're absolutely right, you know, you do it all the time at Kisei Shri, but I tended to fall out of the habit a little bit, and particularly when you're revising, I think it's a really useful thing to get them to think again about the practical.
So that comes into
what was independent, what was dependent, what was control,
and it comes into graphs and graphing telling a story and all that stuff.
Graphing telling a story, what do you do with? So if you've got your variables, you've got how to process your data, and you've got how to make an improvement to the experiment, you're pretty much there in terms of what you need to do for most experimental prescription at GCSE, and possibly for A-level as well.
So you would do practical work? I would definitely do practical work. Past papers, but I mean A-level, past papers till their eyes bleed in revision. After the mocks, I would definitely mark the mock formatively, so I go through it. But I would then, I always make notes of how they do in each question, and I always refer to that when I'm going through it with them. And then I say, well, the average mark on this was 4 out of 9, which is low, and so I take it more slowly, and that does inform what I will give them as past papers in the revision. I think it's a rich source of information, but I don't go through the mock until after I finish the content. I leave the mock, I just keep it in the cupboard.
That makes sense. I think that's a good sense. So basically they do the mock, you mark it, you give them a score presumably, you say, and we will come back to this.
And do you use the official grade boundary, or do you cheat to make it harder?
Depends. I cheat sometimes. The thing is also, we so for A-level mocks, because they haven't finished the content, we have to do a kind of slight subset of the paper.
Yeah. And because that's why I changed. I hated that.
Yeah, well, this is it, because you're taking out the subset that is the advanced A2 stuff. Your grade boundaries are probably a little bit suspect to start with anyway. So, I'll usually tailor them to basically make sure that, you know, if it's a group that I feel is low on confidence, I'll try and give them a boost by perhaps easing them up a little bit. If they're a group that's perhaps a little bit overconfident, perhaps ease them back a bit. So yeah,
I don't think I've ever had an overconfident group in physics. It's so hard. I tell you, I do every exam I give them, whatever that is, I always, until the mocks, is 40E. Do you do that 40E, 50D?
Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, up to a 90A start. But I say there's two exams a year, which I'll use the official mark scheme, and that's the mock AS paper and then the mock after Easter.
Fair play. That's I think that's the time when reality should bite, yeah. So that's okay.
But I also say to them, I also say to them, you know, any, on that 40, 50, 60, if you're within two grades of your target, that's absolutely fine, because you know you're not ready to do the exam yet. And then we hope between Christmas and Easter of the last year you'll get within one grade of your target, and then hopefully after Easter you'll be on your target going forward.
That's a good point. I think that's what I increasingly find myself doing is saying to them, don't panic, you know, that just there's no expectation that at this stage you're the finished article. There will be an awful lot of practice to come, so I'll point to the fact that, you know, you have scored, even when they think they've tanked and scored 33%, I say, well, you've scored 1 in 3 of the marks on this paper. 2 in 3 of marks on this paper is a good grade, usually, because usually 66% on a physics paper is a decent...
66 on the final paper might be a B.
Exactly. So 60, and if these are real physics questions, 66 in a final paper can be a good grade. So I'll say that could be as high as a B. So basically, you are halfway to where you need to be. You've got to double the number of marks you get on the paper, but that is entirely doable in 3 months' time of just solid practice.
Questions. I always reassure them, it's remarkable how it comes together in the last 6 weeks.
Yes.
Once they've covered all the content and they start being able to access the questions that cover the whole course, that you start wheeling out because you've never been able to do that before, because they can't answer any question that's holistic. Well, not synoptic. I would say holistic. And they can't answer any question that's synoptic.
I like holistic. They should be holistic questions.
Holistic. Acupuncture questions. But once they can access those and they start seeing how it all pulls together, it is remarkable how it comes together at the end, and it does boost their confidence.
Yes, I think that is true.
But it only comes because they do any damn revision.
Yeah, they've got to do that too. So that's part of it as well. So when I do hit kids who I think are struggling with that, I tell them to make a timetable and ask them to show it to me. And that timetable should include all their subjects, not just physics, and that it's also a sustainable timetable that they can actually keep up with. And then I tell them to stick to that, because that's the way to get rid of stress as well. Because if you've got a timetable and you know what you're committing to...
Yeah, and if you make a timetable, you realise how little time you've got to revise. And if you say, I'm going to do... an hour a day, and I'm going to do it. Each topic is going to take 2 hours. And you say, work back from the exam then, and it's going to be, they get back. Oh, maybe I should have started 2 weeks ago.
I'll tell you one little tip that I hadn't found anywhere to crowbar in, which I did quite like, is using the visualizer so when you hit a question that they've all struggled with, use the visualizer to basically write it for them in front of them. So you write it how you would do it.
I do that all year. I mean, I don't have a visualizer, but I have a smart board and I make it invisible and I have the PDF and I model every past paper question I do. And I think a lot of teaching is about modeling exam technique. You know, what does explain mean in a physics paper? Well, 95% of the time it means use an equation. That's what it means. And, you know, state and explain. You all got one mark because you just stated, you didn't explain. You know, I think exam technique, that's such an important thing. So it's not just a bit, I do that all year. Every past paper question I go through, I've got an invisible board and I'm writing on the PDF. Everyone.
Good.
Always.
Yep, that's good. And like I say, it's just I think it's one that the kids really respond to. You were saying that sort of when you're doing past papers, you don't go through every question, which is absolutely fine. But there are occasionally ones that stump a lot of them, and modelling that and how you would go through that, I think, is sometimes...
The whole paper, but I just take my time on the ones they find harder.
It just seems to respond to that in a way, and sort of seeing you do it is a really useful thing for them. So, yeah, I mean, I take the point, but it's...
It goes back to that stuff we're talking about, cognitive science, with Ben Rogers. And making it easier. I'd worried for a long time that I make it too easy because I just go to the papers, I tell them all the answers and we carry on. And that's actually good practice. It, you know, keeps the cognitive demand down. And then I set them stuff at home. Do you give them the answers when you give them A-level questions?
Well, I think this day and age they can get the answers because most of the stuff I set them is either from a
AP
or from the textbook, and they just access it. So I do have the credulous students who just sit there and copy out the answers quite happily.
Yeah.
And you just think,
It's rare, though, that, isn't it? Rare and obvious.
Wonder what on earth that you think they're doing. But usually they do get the hint eventually that this is really not helping them, because I could get a year four to do that.
Yeah.
Not really doing so well.
Yeah, I know. Occasionally you have kids who think they're smarter than you and do that. And I just said, what do you do? I don't call them on it, but I do say, it looks like some people are copying the answers. I'm not sure what they think, how they think that's helping them. I'm not going to do anything about it, because it's your lives.
Yeah.
I know who you are. I'm
not going to do anything for you.
I know who you are. Yeah. You're going to be going to university soon. If you think that's going to help you with university, copying out the answers, good luck with that. Yeah. Now, I give them the answers for exactly that reason. They can find them. Mm. And there's a journey, isn't there? When they start off, I say, in AS, I don't know if you do this, but I say, the first homework, I say, here is the homework. The answers are in the back of the book. Go home, copy out the answers. Work towards them. This is where you are in the A-level. You will not, if you can do it straight off, bravo to you. But, you know, work towards the answers. And then when you're more confident in the future, get the answer and compare it with the answer. But never don't check the answers. They're there for a reason.
I do like that. That's a very nice way of putting it. So when you start, work towards the answers, and as you get more confident,
check the
answers.
This is just How Thomas Teaches Physics, isn't it? Yeah, the How Was It? Thomas Teaches Physics podcast, blowing my own trumpet. I mean, I don't think I'm the best teacher in the world, but I've been doing it a long time. I mean, I insist it's self-marked. So I say, you know, do and self-mark. And if it's not marked, they have to mark it in a different colour. If they haven't marked it and shown they've checked it, I give it back to them. That, for me, it was an essential part of my learning, was just grinding through the questions and making sure they're right. And you know, the number of times, you must remember, you get there and the answer's wrong, you think, well, what the hell? And then you go back and you plug through it until you get it right.
Well, I think what you said earlier about the last 6 weeks, it really comes together, is because they start living in the mark scheme and they start to realise what... Because the exam board are pretty consistent, usually, about what they're looking for.
Mm.
And the ways to answer questions and the ways where you talk about a particular phenomenon, like, for example, the gas laws, and you talk about collisions making a change in momentum on the surface. And that, I mean, it's always the same elements of the question. And once they get into that sort of habit of...
Force is the rate of change of momentum. Oh, my God, the kids never mention that. And I beat my head against a brick wall. That comes up so often. And when I teach it to them, I'll get them to put their hand on their heart and say, I promise I will never forget the force of the rate of change of momentum. They all forget it, but in that last 6 weeks, it comes up enough, they go, oh that does make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's because we do ethic was MA, but we should do ethic was delta P and delta T.
Obviously, come on. And we should do it in the original Latin, shouldn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Newton's Principia. And with that, dear listener...
Cogito ergo sum, or whatever it is. So I think that's a bit too much playing my own trumpet today. I feel terrible. We're going to get letters of complaint.
Not at all. No, I think it's really useful, because that's the point, is that people going through this, they want to see, want to hear.
No one will have got this far in the podcast, Robin.
Well, no, that people want to hear about sort of tips and tricks for making it work. And I think those are really good tips. I think the idea, you know, modelling it, reducing cognitive load, all that stuff, it's good stuff.
Well, talking of tips and tricks, we are looking for tips and tricks for teaching momentum.
We are.
We have not been overwhelmed. Again, because we're choosing the hard things, remember we chose ways to teach ionizing radiation. We got like three tips, and now we're doing momentum, and we've had none. So we need to tweet about it more, I think, Robin. We need to tweet using our Twitter handle, @PhysicsTP, and ask people for tips on momentum, #TPTP, momentum.
We're so modern.
We're so modern.
Twitter on our mobile telephonic devices.
Yes.
Truly marvellous.
Marvellous.
Yeah, absolutely. And Instagram as well, @physics_teaching_podcast. Are we looking for tips there as well?
We would be looking for tips there. And you can email us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com, or use our website.
The website is always there for you. And of course, it has the complete back catalogue, lest we forget. So if you're struggling with something and you're wondering how to teach it, you can search through the back catalogue. There's a nice little search function on there, and you can find our Ways to Teach Waves episode.
Yeah, we need a better archive. I'm fully aware of that. And now I'm coming out of my despondency that I've been in. I feel I should talk about this, actually, because, dear listener, I've been really struggling recently because my beloved cousin had a glioma, which is a brain tumour, and he passed away. Sorry, dear listener, but I'm saying this because he passed away over Christmas, and it's broken the family's heart, but we're trying to raise money for the brain charity.
So how can we do that?
There is a link which I'll put in the notes, but it's if you go to, I think it's Virgin Giving, and you search Bartholomew Beale, he was a remarkably talented artist. The funeral was unbelievable. Standing room only 500 people. Mm. And one of the presenters of Sky Arts was there to talk about his art. It was beautiful. Mm. Very young. He was a remarkable man.
He was indeed. I had the privilege of meeting him on one occasion when we went on a demo together.
Always happy. Always happy. Always smiling. The complete opposite of what you think a tortured soul or an artist is. Just the happiest guy. He lived in the moment. That was his thing. He lived in the moment. Yes, if you go to Virgin Giving and you search for Bartholomew Beale, he was really proud of that name. It was great for him because it's really easy to Google him as an artist. It's already raised 5,000 quid and climbing. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously very close to our hearts and the family. It's been brutal.
A lovely thing to raise some money for in his memory. How old was he when he passed away?
30.
Just 30. So, yeah.
So I'm coming out of my shell. I made a decision today too. I've got to start moving forward. Hopefully the kids will benefit from that too.
Mm.
We're just getting that link out to as many people as we can in the hope we can raise more money so that anyone in the situation we had can have some support. Dear old Barley.
Yeah, God bless him.
Mm. That's a sad note to end the podcast on. But dear listener, hopefully we have a guest next week. We're getting back into things. Mm. We have a guest next week and we're going to be talking about our impending trip to Boston.
Yep, we're off to America, which will be fun.
And yeah, it's coming up. So we're looking forward to that. And then hopefully we've got more guests lined up in the future.
Yes, I'm off to do Duke of Edinburgh Award in the Yorkshire Dales. And then I shall get back and the next day I'm flying to Boston. So I shall feel like a proper teaching person. It's going to be quite weird. Yeah.
Well, sorry to end the podcast like that, Robin, but thank you very much.
Thank you indeed, Thomas. I shall catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. The podcast is presented by Robin Griffiths and me, Thomas WP, and produced and edited by me, Thomas WP. Do share your ideas. We'd love having guests on. And do share the podcast with anyone you think who might benefit. We're still growing and hope you can find some more people out there who'll enjoy having a little bit of geeky physics chat during the week. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.